into the Jackie Washington character. What distinguished Jackie from me most was that she would never doubt herself. She believed her own bullshit, that she was fabulous always and forever. I, on the other hand, might proclaim, I'm fabulous, but then pull back and cry myself to sleep, racked with self-doubt. Barry Cross, my manager at the time, tried to sell the script all over town. Lifetime picked it up, and the one and only Robert Townsend was chosen to direct. All y'all need to know is that during the first meeting with the Lifetime executives, one of them raised her hand timidly and, referring to the script, asked,
"What does cuff what? Thank you, say no more, mean."
In his thick English accent, Barry replied, "Oh, darling, I honestly don't know what it means, but when Jackie Washington says it, it's quite clear." I found that producing a movie is a whole nother thing, very different from creating a stage production for one actor. In producing, the bottom line is money. I was fortunate that my friends put me, not compensation, first. We rallied a long list of greats to make cameo appearances. The first person I called was Whoopi. Now, something you guys should know. Because I had become the entertainer's entertainer, all the divas who loved me sort of competed in claiming responsibility for my becoming a star. So I was no fool. I played them against each other. With love, of course. I told Whoopi I had Bet. I told Bet I had Whoopi. I told Rosie I had Bet and Whoopi. I told Loretta I had Whoopi, Bet, and Rosie. Barry Cross got Dolly Parton and Joe Beth Williams. Robert Townsend got Don Cornelius. I snatched Chris Rock just walking across the lawn at the Beverly Hills Hotel. If you look closely and listen, he has no idea what he's talking about. What he's saying doesn't even make sense. But who cares? It was Chris Rock, and he did it for Jennifer Lewis. When they told me Tim Curry would be my co-star, all I could think of was him in that bustier and garter belt in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I proceeded to levitate off the ground. The shit was set in motion. Robert Townsend took a crew to the set of Girl Interrupted and got Whoopi in costume as a nurse. I had been up for that part, bitch. They went to New York and got Liza Minnelli. Un-fucking-believable. Then, when the head of Lifetime, Laurette Hayton, called and told me her mother had agreed to do a cameo, I proceeded to jump as high as the Maasai in Nguru Girl. Her mother was, of course, the legendary actress Eva Marie Saint, Miss North by Northwest herself. Then Jackie Collins agreed to say that Jackie Washington had died from choking on a chitlin. We got Kathy Najimy, Kathy Griffin, and Sean Hayes. When Diane Carroll proclaimed she had built herself from the ground up and was calling her lawyer to sue Jackie, whatever mind I had was lost. When Penny Marshall nasaled her way through her monologue, the gods came down from the heavens and blessed the entire production. One theme of the movie is a corny double entendre. We named Jackie Washington's youngest daughter Entendre, and then had Jackie ask her for a drink and make the obvious request. Ready? Make it a double entendre. The environment on the set equaled one word, laughter. My favorite scene is when Jackie comes out of the house drunk and tells the detective, "Wait a minute, so she can fix her hair for the cameras after stabbing Milkman, her husband, with an afro pick. By the way, Milkman was played by the wonderful Richard Lawson, who later married Tina Knowles, Beyoncé's mama. I actually went on a date with him. Shit, had I known Tina would be my competition, I'd have worn a lower neckline. But seriously, Richard and I were no Jackie and Milkman. We became more like sister and brother, which is very cool. In the movie, when you see that Playboy spread with Jackie's legs in a wide split, I just want y'all to know that's my real body. I am a yoga and Pilates diva after all. And let's not forget captain of the fucking cheerleading squad in high school. On the day we shot the Coco scene, Rudy Ray Moore, portraying the main gangster, could not get the line right. He was supposed to say, "I'll see you in the sequel, Coco." But in take after take, he kept calling her Chacon over and over again. Chacon, Chacon, Chacon. So in the looping session, I begged Robert Townsend to let me say Chacon for no good reason before Coco kicks ass in that scene. To this day, Mark Brown and I end every phone conversation not with goodbye, but with "I will see you in the sequel, Chacon." The day before shooting the scene with David Hyde Pierce, who played my deaf pianist, we had filmed a full-out production of Love Goddess, accompanied by my high kicks over and over again. The next day, at the piano, when I had to kick over my head, it was impossible. The pain you see when I tried to raise my leg was probably the most real moment in the film. Luckily, the genius of David Hyde Pierce masked it. Isabel Sanford portrayed Jackie's play mama, Miss Crooms, who famously says, "White people smell like wet potato chips." Between takes, Isabel told me stories about Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy on the set of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Apparently, Katharine was appalled that Isabel took the public bus to the set every day. She insisted Isabel be given a chauffeured car. Mark Shaman was an unbelievable friend to score the movie for close to nothing. He was in the midst of scoring Ghosts of Mississippi, so we worked on Jackie's back during his lunch breaks. His favorite lyric in the entire movie is in Love Goddess. "Just like Aphrodite in her 90, you're like Thor, I'm like Venus, something's got to come between us, Love Goddess." Jackie's back was in the can and left with the editor. We crossed our fingers and something deep inside me told me it was going to be good. When Jackie's back was finally ready, Barry Cross wouldn't even let me see it until he threw an intimate party to celebrate. I wanted to kill him. I wanted to make sure it was good before anyone else saw it. I walked into the party wearing a hoodie under my coat and repressing the rage of a petulant 5-year-old not getting her way. Inside, I was yearning, hoping, and praying to God, "Please let it be good." I refused all hors d'oeuvres and drinks. I clutched up in a chair in fetal position, not making eye contact, and I was silent. Silent? Y'all know I was scared. During shooting, I had seen most, but not all, of the dailies. When the movie came on, I stayed clutched up until Liza Minnelli, whose dailies I had not seen, came on the screen. When she said,
"I don't know much about the African,"
The hoodie dropped, the coat flew off, and I came out of my body screaming in joy. Somebody break out the champagne. Jackie's back was, in fact, the best shit I had ever seen. humbly. At the premiere, I spotted Rachel in the crowd. I could tell how proud she was of me, like a peacock strutting his beautiful plumage. Everybody was happy. Everybody was proud. A lot of people flew in, including Dr. Roma Littlewalker, a friend I'd met on my trip to Egypt, Mrs. Butler, my high school counselor, and Ethel Rue, my fat Jackie partner from Kinlock. My cousin Ronnie did cartwheels. We had a late-night celebration at Kate Mantellini restaurant in Beverly Hills. A few days later, I left for New York, but I didn't really need the plane. I was flying high, heading to the city to promote Jackie's back on the Rosie O'Donnell Show. I had been dating a man named Terrence for about a year at this time and brought him with me. When we landed back at LAX, Lifetime has sent a limousine for us. On the ride home, Terrence, who played a TV reporter in the film, spotted a huge billboard for Jackie's back with my face 10 feet tall. We screamed and shouted while our heads stuck out of the limo sunroof. The billboards were all over the city. The premiere of the film, June 22nd, 1999, was one of the happiest days of my life. Flowers and gifts streamed in from Whoopi, Penny Marshall, Tony Braxton, The Boat, my sisters and brothers. Whitney and Bobby sent the largest roses I had ever seen. They were from Africa. Wow. Unfortunately, the ratings for Jackie's back were low. I guess the Lifetime core audience was just not ready for my shenanigans. Fuck 'em if they can't take a joke. But the critics received it, as they had received mostly everything I had done. Raves, 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 raves. Life went on. Over the years, Jackie's back has developed a cult following. All kinds of people. Black folks, gypsies, soccer moms, the gay community. Stop me on planes, in movie theaters, or at the mall when I'm bra shopping. And tell me they watch the movie over and over again. It even has its own holiday, Jackie Washington Day, which is celebrated on July 15th. I've been to events where people dress up like characters in the movie and recite the dialogue right along with the actors, just like the fans of Rocky Horror. After the wonderful experience of Jackie's Back, I got incredible news from Mark and Bobby. They had decided to become parents by adopting a child. They asked me to write a letter of reference for the judge for them. I was honored to do that. It was like an affirmation of our committed friendship. I was present with them when the adoption was confirmed. I was the first to hold Ella Cesaria Brown after Mark and Bobby. They named her after Ella Fitzgerald. She was exceptionally beautiful. I remember saying to my own beautiful daughter, Charmaine, "She's got face," meaning she has beauty and personality. Mark and Bobby adopted their wonderful son, Sander, a few years later. It has been a monumental pleasure for this here godmama to love and spoil them rotten. 14. Mother Courage. On screen, I have portrayed Whitney's mama, Tupac's mama, Taraji's mama, Terrence J's mama, Gabrielle's mama, and Raven Simone's grandmother. I even played Angela Bassett's mama in What's Love Got to Do with It, despite just being 18 months older than her. Sometimes I think they're going to ask me to play Miss Jane Pittman's mama next. Off screen, I never thought of myself as motherly. But God knows that I play with everybody's baby. In my family, among fans, and even in the grocery store. I may be a high diva sometimes, but nothing humbles my ass quicker than a cute little baby. When I was in love with Thomas, there was a point where I thought we would marry and have a baby. But as time went on, having kids just fell off my to-do list. When Rachel and my boat sister suggested that I consider being more active in the lives of children, I was surprised. They weren't saying jump into motherhood right away. They thought it would be good for me to start out by mentoring. I definitely had the energy for hanging out with children and had a sense of fun along with a desire to give back. Several months passed as I continued to work with Rachel and on my own until I felt more confident about embarking on my new venture as a big sister. Many of my friends supported my intention. Deborah Dean Davis wrote a letter of recommendation, and Tom Fennessy was by my side from the start, going with me to the initial meetings with Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America. I was in orientation with them to learn my responsibilities and their process. I went to the community center to meet lanky, adorable, 7-year-old Charmaine for the first time. She was balled up under a table when I first laid eyes on her. She reminded me of myself when I collapsed on the floor of Beverly Heath's friend's kitchen. My heart was drawn immediately to this pretty, skinny, long-legged little girl. She was very shy, and when I finally made her smile, she revealed an adorable snaggle tooth right in front. Though I've never been shy a day in my life, the connection I felt to Charmaine was immediate, perhaps because I understood her circumstances. Charmaine's normal resembled mine as a child back in Kinloch. One woman holding down multiple jobs to support multiple children by herself. It was my pleasure to share myself and my resources with this precious little girl. Charmaine and I established a routine where I'd pick her up once a week. She was always anxiously waiting for me at her door. We'd go somewhere fun or just hang out at my place. At first, I had no idea what the hell I was doing. One day, not being able to reach one of my girlfriends, I was forced to call my agent from Whole Foods to ask, "What do you feed a 7-year-old?" The first time Charmaine opened my refrigerator, all she saw was a bottle of champagne and a jar of caviar. I ate pretty healthy, but usually ordered in. I loved every minute we spent together. It felt so good to do for Charmaine what had not been done for me. I'd take her to museums and movies, and also made sure that she got outdoors and learned to enjoy nature. Plus, we went shopping a lot. Our first Halloween together, we spent the entire afternoon searching for exactly the right costume. At Toys R Us, I bought her Barbie dolls and books. In fact, I bought her everything I thought she might want. Well, as much as Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America allowed, they had rules and regulations for everything. There was even a limit on how much time Big Sisters could spend with their mentees. I was around as much as possible, sometimes bending the rules. Charmaine had become more than a mentee. The first time Charmaine slept over was Thanksgiving. I slowly and gently brushed her hair and then read to her from her favorite book, The 11th Hour, A Curious Mystery. When I tucked her in, her sincere little voice said, "Thank you, Jenny." It was the first time she called me by the name that pretty much only my family uses. I was scared to death thinking of the million things that could go wrong. I kept waking up to check on her, and finally, just watched her sleep peacefully. I gave Charmaine lots of hugs, smiles, and laughter. I also found, surprisingly, I drew from my mother's attitude that you had to toughen up children to prepare them for life. For example, I wanted Charmaine to build her physical stamina. So, as we hiked the hills, I would walk very fast, pushing her lanky, mildly uncoordinated little body to keep up. I think the day Charmaine had an asthma attack triggered by an allergy was the day I really understood what it was to be a mother. We were spending some casual time together, and when Charmaine began to cough and gasp uncontrollably, I immediately put her in the car and sped to the hospital. She was fine, but sitting in that emergency room with her for 4 hours scared the shit out of me. I think I discovered that night what true love was. A few weeks later, I took Charmaine with me to the Magic Johnson Theater to see The Preacher's Wife. I always loved watching my films with predominantly black audiences. In one scene with Denzel, my character entered wearing a very unattractive outfit. A woman behind me shouted, "What the hell is she wearing?" I, of course, had gone to the theater incognito, and Charmaine and I proceeded to laugh and laugh. She loved that her big sister was a movie star. When I had a new movie coming out, Charmaine loved to stay up with me until midnight, when we'd rush to the 24-hour newsstand to read the reviews in the morning papers. It was obvious that Charmaine was not the only one of us in need, and we both benefited from our paths crossing. I monitored myself because I wanted to be a good example. I was motivated to stay in my adult and let Charmaine be the child. It didn't always work out that way. I got hypnotized to stop smoking. And after Charmaine came into my life, there was never another one-night stand. And believe it or not, I made sure never to expose little Charmaine to my cursing. Not counting road rage. I still had my issues, though. I was not in a relationship and was still trying to buy my mother's love, despite confronting her about her treatment of me as a child. But my progress was undeniable. I was learning to sit with my feelings instead of acting them out. Let's just say I was still the life of the party, singing, dancing, and clowning around. But at least I wasn't doing it on top of the table or on top of somebody's head. One night, I was driving and feeling comfortable that I knew the road well enough to glance up at the moon through the sunroof. Bam! I hit the guardrail. My car went into a 360 spin, and I ended up in a ditch. The driver door was smashed in. I pried myself out and crawled up the embankment in total shock. When I looked down at my car, my first thought was that my body was dead in the car, and my spirit had floated out of it. I thought of Charmaine and how I wanted to be in her life always. Then I thought, damn, the headline tomorrow will be Double D Cup Diva, Dead in Ditch. The car was banged up, and so was I. But I felt I could drive. It was a foolish decision, but I made it home safely. Charmaine and I had grown extremely close, so it was difficult to tell her I would not see her while I went to New York to work with Spike Lee on Girl 6. She didn't seem too disappointed, though, because I sent her to Camp Hollywood Land for the summer. In New York, I had a great time hanging out with my cast members, Teresa Randall and Naomi Campbell. We'd go to the spa together, to dinner, and to parties. It was all very upscale New York. A 180-degree difference from my early days trudging to Gray's Papaya. One morning, Naomi called and asked if I wanted to join her for breakfast in one of her favorite restaurants in Lower Manhattan. She was dating some czar at the time and had just returned from Russia. As we gorged on fresh black sturgeon eggs, who walked in but John F. Kennedy Jr.? My heart leapt. My legs moved, and I was in front of him within seconds. Now, I know it's difficult to imagine Jennifer Lewis speechless, but I just stood there like a 16-year-old in love. I wanted to say something intelligent, but the only words I could muster were, "My God, you're beautiful." He looked me in the eye, took my hand, and said, "So are you." Had he kissed my hand, I would have been walking around with it filthy to this very day. Charmaine's mom, LaRonda, had more on her shoulders than any woman should bear. Not only was she the sole provider for her children, but she had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. We didn't become close friends, but we did sit down for long conversations. LaRonda trusted me with all of her children. Charmaine's three sisters all had big sisters, but I loved to scoop up all the girls myself and take them on special outings to the beach or Disneyland. But there was tension among the siblings. It didn't help that I was a well-off celebrity and that Charmaine was somewhat the runt of her sisters. As LaRonda's health deteriorated, Charmaine came to live with me full-time. Eventually, we all agreed that I would become Charmaine's legal guardian. It wasn't exactly adoption, but legal guardianship allowed me to assume all responsibility for the little girl I loved so much. I promised LaRonda that I would do my best for Charmaine, including getting her through high school and college. Immediately, I enrolled her in an expensive private school because I wanted her to have the best. Journal entry. Was my mother depressed every day of her life? Is it what I learned? Can I live another way? I'm fighting so hard. These realizations and revelations mean nothing, Jenny, unless you hold on to them and don't drop the ball. Don't drop the ball, baby. Becoming Charmaine's parent helped me to better understand my mother's predicament. I had just one child and could only imagine the pressure Mama felt trying to raise seven. Unlike Mama, I had the time and resources to focus on my child. I showered Charmaine with attention, listened to her, and encouraged her to talk about her feelings and what she wanted in life. I saw that Charmaine felt pulled by the sometimes opposing forces of her birth family and me. The life she led with me was the polar opposite of her family's struggle. Having grown up poor myself, I certainly understood the conflict she was feeling. Because LaRonda had become too ill to take care of her children, Charmaine's two older sisters had been sent to live with relatives, and her younger sister, Angelica, had entered the foster care system. I think Charmaine felt guilty that she seemed to have lucked out in such an extreme way. At first, as her big sister, I let Charmaine have her way on just about everything. She was quite artistic, and when we made a birdhouse out of popsicle sticks, I let her stay up until midnight to finish it. I found out soon, however, that as Charmaine's parent, I couldn't always say yes. I now had to say no sometimes. That was hard for both of us. I didn't want to replicate my mother's super strict approach and struggle to find the right balance between big sister and disciplinarian. For instance, I grew up poor, but our homes were clean. My mother said, "When I get home, this house better be spotless." And we knew there would be hell to pay if it wasn't. But Charmaine's standards were different from mine, and her refusal to clean her room to my liking resulted in my putting her on punishment. Worse, it caused anger and resentment between us. My favorite cousin Ronnie, who had become a professional hairstylist, came out to L.A. again to help me with Charmaine. He was sweet as pie. And so patient. He drove Charmaine to school, did the cooking, and styled Charmaine's hair, which of course she loved. Ronnie could dance. He could sing. He only had a high school education, but he was smart, fun-loving, and a natural caretaker. It felt good to build a little family with Charmaine and Ronnie, and the little apricot poodle, Cashew, that I got Charmaine for her birthday. Sheldon Epps, the brilliant artistic director of the esteemed Pasadena Playhouse, asked me to perform there in a play, John Henry Redwood's The Old Settler. My castmates were Christopher B. Duncan, Sally Richardson, and the incomparable C.C.H. Pounder. Settler was the first straight, meaning non-musical, play I had performed in since college. I had done only musicals and concerts since. One night, after the final curtain, a young man peered his head in my dressing room while I was removing my makeup. Oh, was he cute. I had taken a bite out of a Chinese pear. It was a juicy one. He said, "Can I have a bite?" Well, let's just say he came in and had a bite. For the next 9 years, we would continue to take bites out of that Chinese pear. God help me. Enter Terrence Flack. My first boyfriend after a long dry spell. On our first date, we hiked up Fryman Canyon, and he bent down to tie my shoe. I liked him on his knees. The rest, ladies and gentlemen, is history. I dated Terrence for a month and a half before I actually slept with him. I was trying to be an adult and get to know somebody before I launch into bed with them. As you all know by now, that had not been my modus operandi in the past. Over the months, I spent more time with Terrence. He was fun. He did not take my shit, and he was not afraid of me. I could be myself with him, and he made me laugh. Terence was well-read and a true lover of music. He liked to tease me, making fun of my dramatics by calling me Grown Crawford. There were some red flags, like his woe-is-me attitude, which wasn't surprising given his background. Of all the men I dated, Terence had been the most abused. His mother was overwhelmed by her parental responsibilities, and agents from the Children's Services Bureau were trying to place her children with other relatives. With the agents on her heels, Terence's mother bundled up her toddlers and headed for the Greyhound bus station. Just as she was about to board the bus, the social workers caught up with her. Little Terence was sent to live with relatives who were far too strict. Terence had survived, pretty much raised himself, graduated from college, and come to Los Angeles to pursue acting. I wanted to take care of him. I wanted him to take my hand, and I wanted us to win. I wanted two little black kids who had grown up in poverty to go around the world and leave it all behind. Oops. We take ourselves with us, don't we? Ultimately, I introduced him to Charmaine. I felt proud for her to see me with an intelligent, creative man. Terence was supportive of my relationship with Charmaine. I was happy at work and in my off hours. My relationship with Terence grew, and I realized I loved him one morning when I actually cooked for breakfast. In truth, he may have thought I hated him after that. In fact, when my sister see me on screen playing somebody like Mama Rose in The Temptations, serving up platters of fried chicken, collard greens, and peach cobbler, they call me up. You may be fooling the audience, Jenny, but everyone in Kinloch knows you can't cook. When Charmaine went to summer camp, Terence and I ran off to Paris. Late one night, we walked through the Pigalle area. He was a little ahead of me as I climbed a small hill. Terence stopped, turned around, and he reached both his arms out to me, pulling me up the hill, saying, "Come on, baby." It was one of the most loving moments. I think that this night I felt surrounded by angels, and he was one of them. I was becoming a woman of a certain age who was an endangered species in television and film. I felt especially grateful to have a vital career, including a schedule that allowed me to have a stable life at home with a child and a gorgeous man to love on. My maturity did not cause a shortage of excitement and glamour in my life, though. I was thrilled to go to work on Strong Medicine every day. Tammy Ader and Whoopi Goldberg were the creators and producers. I loved and admired them both. Strong Medicine was more than good. It was making history in that it was dealing with women's health issues, honestly. Plus, it featured strong women who were breaking through the barrier of patriarchy. Girl power in these streets. I remember episodes about breast cancer and anti-abortion protests. They even did an episode speaking to my own experience, in which my character, Lana Hawkins, became a mentor to a young girl who had come from hard times. Terence and I took another much-needed vacation to Europe. His mood dampened the trip for me. He was often uncomfortable about me spending money on such luxuries. He felt it somehow compromised his manhood. We went to a fireworks display in Monaco. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, with music by Tchaikovsky playing in the background. I looked around and didn't see Terence, who had been walking with me. He was sitting on the curb with his head down. He was overwhelmed. He felt unworthy. I had built this lavish life, and he was thrown into it, and apparently he was drowning. He had his insecurities, I had mine. We got tickets for the Phantom of the Opera in the West End in London. At dinner I asked, "Do you think I'm beautiful?" It was one of the few times he looked me squarely in the eyes and answered, "Jennifer, you're so beautiful sometimes it's hard to look at you." Looking to boost Terence's self-esteem, I got him a job on strong medicine. He needed the money, and we stupidly thought being together night and day would strengthen our relationship. Of course, it had the opposite effect. Journal entry. I feel so foolish sometimes where Terence is concerned. He could be playing me. Am I afraid of being alone? But I can't take being with him at work and at home. He's got to get the fuck out of strong medicine. It's killing us, I believe. That's what I wrote, but it's not what I told Terence. Instead, our relationship sort of limped along. Both of us wanting it to work, but neither of us willing to admit it wasn't. I was a bit surprised when Terence proposed, by nearly throwing the ring at me. Suffice it to say, the moment wasn't as romantic as I might have hoped. Ronnie was present. Terence seemed detached during the whole thing. I was afraid to announce it to anyone. I didn't even want to tell Charmaine. Terence went with me to St. Louis for Christmas that year, but I think he was stressing over whether he could handle marriage or not. We were still going on and off with our bullshit. Impulsively, we ran away after Christmas to Cancun to celebrate the new millennium. We said, if the world does end, at least we'll be somewhere pretty and together. It didn't work. We fought like dogs the entire time. As Charmaine entered her teens, everything changed. She turned into Reagan from The Exorcist. We tangled about homework, summer school, everything. She was secretive. Of course, I was frightened about drugs and was uncomfortable with some of the kids she hung out with. Charmaine held a pool party while I was away. I lit into her and used the F word over and over. I apologized profusely. I had been abusive and was truly sorry. I felt even worse the next morning when I had to leave Charmaine in order to fly to Florida to join Bette Midler and Kirsten Dunst at a campaign rally for John Kerry, the Democratic nominee for president. While in Florida, I got the call that my cousin Ronnie was in a coma in a hospital in St. Louis. I rushed home to sit by Ronnie's side and hold his hand. Though he could not hear me, I thanked him for helping me raise Charmaine and told him how much I loved him. I hugged him and whispered in his ear, "You go to sleep now, baby, if you want to. But hold on a minute, Ronnie. My hair looks like shit." I knew he was laughing inside. My dear, talented, sweet cousin Ronnie passed away. Shame had prevented him from speaking out about his illness and from getting treatment. Once again, I had witnessed how secrets destroy lives. To help Charmaine and myself recover from Ronnie's death, we took a short trip to Hawaii. I wanted to show Charmaine that I trusted her, so I gave her freedom to stay out late if she wanted to. I was nervous, though, and pretended to be asleep when she came home a little too late for my taste. She still claims she was so not late. I received a call while in Hawaii that the role I wanted in Lackawanna Blues had gone to my friend S. Epatha Murkison, who turned in a brilliant performance. When I got home, glory hallelujah, I was offered 5 movies, including Nora's Hair Salon, The Cookout, and Antoine Fisher. In Charmaine's junior year of high school, she got herself into a not-so-good relationship with a pretty white boy. She was in emotional pain for nearly a year, but couldn't find the strength to end it. To get Charmaine's mind on other things, I snatched her up and took her to Italy. This was the first time I'd taken her to a foreign country, and maybe I was a little too protective. She was 18 now, and I had to let my baby girl grow up. Damn. We visited Florence, drove through Tuscany, and when we got to Pisa, I rushed her out of the car shouting, "Come on! Come on before it falls!" as we laughingly rushed toward the Leaning Tower. In Rome, we went shopping around the Spanish Steps, and I bought her 2 prom dresses. We were lucky enough to catch the last tour of the Vatican before it was announced that Pope John Paul II had died. We were scheduled to go home the next day, but the flights had been canceled because of the onslaught of people who had rushed to Rome for the Pope's funeral and selection of the new pontiff. We even saw the smoke from the chimney. Between having to stay a couple of extra nights and the long trip back to Los Angeles, I totaled 4 days off my medication, which triggered a manic episode when I got home. The first morning, I took a spin in my car, still thinking about the wonderful trip to Italy, but happy to be back in our beautiful neighborhood, which was awash with purple jacaranda blooms. I turned a corner and found myself looking at a brand new tile-roofed home that reminded me of Tuscany. The house was beige with green shutters, and in classic Tuscan style, every window had a different shape. I had to see inside. When the man who built the house walked me through it, I began to sing. The house matched what was going on inside me. I was inside a manic episode, and the house was as big as my feelings. The contractor, Joseph Aviv, brought his father, Moses, with him. Joseph and Moses, what an audience! I started singing You Raise Me Up by Josh Groban at the top of my lungs. Ah, the acoustics in an empty house. I fawned over Moses and asked if he knew the 10 Commandments and who Nefertiti was. Apparently, other people were bidding on the house, but Moses was entranced by my joy and told Joseph to sell it to me. Thus, in a highly manic state and without due consideration, I bought the house. But when my manic mood subsided, one night I sat up straight in bed and thought, how much did I just spend? What the fuck have I done? We moved into our new home a few weeks before Charmaine finished high school. She enrolled in college that fall, but dropped out 2 years later. I was terribly disappointed. She promised to return to college, and I set her up with an apartment, car, and allowance. But when she told me she wasn't going back to school, our relationship hit a low point. Nearly 3 years passed, during which LaRonda passed away. When Charmaine and I finally reconciled, we talked about the great and not so great times. From her perspective, I gave her a voice in the way that I had raised her. Then I took that voice away. From my perspective, I encouraged her to have a voice. But when she used it to be disrespectful, I had to shut it down. I wasn't the perfect mother, but I am grateful that Charmaine understands I did my best. Working through all this with Charmaine has helped me come to terms with my mama. To see that she also did her best, even if I felt it wasn't enough. After Charmaine moved out, I had time to face the fact that things with Terrence were pretty bad. For one thing, I realized I was getting a little tired of picking up the tab all the time. This had been a running issue in my life. Though I've never minded sharing my success, we all must be careful of becoming a damn fool. Another thing was Terrence couldn't really talk about his deepest feelings. I realized that his horrible experiences as a child caused him to become emotionally disconnected. There was nothing mean about Terrence. Though intelligent, he was still just a scared little boy that had major arrested development. But I wasn't willing to give up on us yet. I was asked to perform on a gay cruise to Alaska, but like a damn fool, I took Terrence with me. What came of that? Me threatening gay men left and right. When I thought I caught him looking at Terrence, I'd say, "Okay, this one's mine. Fuck with him, and I'll sink this ship like the Titanic." They laughed, not realizing I was dead serious. I love my gay babies. Ultimately, Terrence broke up with me. The first man who ever did that. It was usually me who ended my relationships. In a last-ditch effort to heal our relationship, we ran off to Japan. Tokyo, Kyoto, Kamakura, Osaka, and dear God, Hiroshima, where the United States dropped the atom bomb at the end of World War II. As I entered Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum, I saw a banner hanging low. It was written in Japanese, but in my mind it read, "Look upon this shame. Look what you did to us." There was a concrete block that still had the shadow of a man who had been disintegrated in less than a second. There were photographs of children and families and animals that I cannot begin to describe, nor will I try. Just know that I vomited when I came out of the museum. After nearly 8 years together, Terrence abandoned me halfway up Mount Fuji. We had taken a train out from Tokyo one afternoon and then grabbed a taxi from the station to the base of the mountain. We didn't realize the taxi driver drove us to the wrong side of the mountain, leaving us at the path reserved for expert climbers and military training. Thus, not only was the trail of crushed lava rocks difficult to walk on, the angle of incline was extreme. Nevertheless, it was beautiful, and the cumulus clouds gathering at the mountaintop seemed to call us upward. After about an hour of climbing, despite my athleticism, I was out of breath, drenched in sweat, and knew I couldn't go on. When I told Terence, he half-heartedly offered to descend with me. I said, "Nah, you go on up. I'll be okay." Trusting he would, of course, insist on accompanying me back down, especially given my obvious physical distress. To my surprise, however, he was relieved. "That cloud is calling me," he said. "I want to go all the way to the top, Jennifer. So you go on, I'll meet you back at the hotel." I slowly and precariously crunched my way down the mountain. The temperature dropped a good 10 degrees as the sun set. Within moments, it was damn near pitch black, and I could neither see nor hear anyone else on the trail. "Okay, y'all, my alpha ass was no match for Miss Mighty Mount Fuji. Jennifer motherfucking Lewis became plain old scared." Worst of all, I could not avoid acknowledging that actions speak louder than words. Terence's actions had shown me what he was not man enough to tell me. That he was no longer there for me. That he no longer prioritized my well-being. And that our relationship was, in fact, over. I managed to climb down the dangerous trail by myself and make it back to the hotel, okay? Journal entry. Help me, God, that I was ever with a man like this. The bottom line is I was too much of a goddamn man myself. There was a part of me that chose men I could dominate. Was my fault that I made more money than they did, dumb bastards? Why couldn't they enjoy it and just be nice? Fuck y'all! After appearing for 6 years as a regular cast member on Strong Medicine, the top-rated show on Lifetime, I got the horrific news that it was being canceled. There were many what the fucks thrown around by me. I soon calmed down when Reuben Cannon called and offered me Tyler Perry's Madea's Family Reunion. I really needed this job. But the offer came in extremely low. I was disappointed because I had already done so many low-budget independent films for Reuben Cannon. I don't know where I got the balls from, but I said no. I was thinking to myself, fuck the mortgage. I want to be respected in this business. I've worked hard on myself, and found the strength to just say no. 2 hours later, Tyler Perry called and said, "Jennifer, what do I have to do to have you in my film?" I gave him my quote, and he said yes. Ha! Merry Christmas, bitches! A few months later, I went to the premiere of Cars, in which I voiced a 1957 Cadillac named Flo. The premiere was in Charleston, North Carolina, at a NASCAR event. Jesus Christ! What a scene! And the roar of the car motors was deafening. And everyone in the stadium seemed to be eating fried turkey legs and drinking kegs of beer.